welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams speaking to you from a very sunny Cambridge here in the UK. Hope you're doing well wherever you are today. My guest today is Jesse Farnestock at the Global Maritime Forum. Jesse is Head of Research and Analysis at GMF, a position he has held since January 2021. His work there covers research and innovation on zero-emission shipping fuels, including analytical work, the development of industry-led first mover projects, and the promotion of green shipping corridors. Jesse's been there for a little bit over a year, but comes with more than 20 years' experience in sustainability and environmental projects. Jesse, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Now, for those of you who are unable to attend the Ship Energy Summit in Valencia at the end of April, you should probably know that Jesse was one of the speakers there and gave a great presentation about green corridors, and I thought it would be wonderful to have him on the podcast to come and reprise his presentation and talk to you all about green corridors as well. So let's dive straight in. And Jesse, please, could you explain for those of us who don't know the concept of green corridors, what are they all about?
Sure. I guess I kind of need to start that answer by saying that decarbonizing global shipping is hard. It's a big challenge. And that's for a number of reasons. One is, you know, related to the technologies available. It's counted amongst the hard to abate sectors because it can't be easily electrified. It needs quite a bit of fuel to fuel its voyages. This creates technological challenges. But there are other kinds of challenges as well, and one that's been talked about a lot in the sector is the so-called chicken and egg problem, that we have neither zero-emission vessels nor zero-emission shipping fuels available today. And so in order to start the transition to a zero-emission shipping sector, you need to overcome the chicken and egg problem where the investors in the vessels are waiting for the fuels to be available, and the investors in the fuels are waiting for the vessels to be available. Aside from that, shipping is also a very diverse and disaggregated sector compared to, say, the power sector. Shipping is done in different ways with different business models, different operational models all around the world. It's very complex. And green corridors, put simply, are a way to kind of simplify that challenge. So by looking at some specific routes and focusing on developing and deploying the zero emission vessels and fuels and fueling infrastructure on those routes that have maybe some advantageous conditions for doing so, you can overcome some of these complexities. So one way of thinking about it is that green corridors can bring shipping's decarbonization down to a manageable size while still keeping it at a relevant scale. So if you decarbonize a whole route, you're still developing things at full commercial and operational scale and likely to have spillover effects to other parts of shipping. So we like to think of green corridors as that sweet spot where the zero emission solutions can be accelerated.
So it's a way of driving decarbonization through focus and achievable scale.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And you know, there are a couple of elements which we can get into later that need to be in place. But we basically think that there are some routes that are the low-hanging fruit of shipping decarbonization. And I'm not saying it's hanging particularly low. It's still challenging. But that should allow the transition to get started and maybe accelerate a little faster than if you tried to do it everywhere at once.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those lower hanging fruits? What are the examples you can give us of existing green corridors?
Well, I actually wouldn't say that there are any green corridors in existence today, not the way we define it. So we define a green corridor as a route on which the zero emission shipping is catalyzed and enabled by both policies and industry actions. That means so there are special regulations or incentives in place related to that route, and there are special industry efforts, for example, joint ventures dedicated to deploying the zero emission innovations on that route. And I don't think any route in the world lives up to that definition at this point. That said, there are a couple of efforts emerging right now. So we published a report last year that really sort of scanned the major global trading lanes and looked at what might be the highest impact and most feasible options for decarbonizing global shipping. We came up with some proposals in that report. Those are just proposals. It's just a report. But one of them, for example, is the trade in iron ore out of Australia to East Asia. So that we think is a very good candidate for an early green shipping corridor for a number of reasons, which we can get into later when we maybe talk about the building blocks of these corridors. It's important to say that the corridor doesn't exist yet. But what we do see is a lot of interest from both relevant interest from governments in these technologies that are involved, and also a lot of interest from the participants in the value chain. And at the Global Maritime Forum, for example, we've put together a small targeted consortium of companies interested in pushing the advancement of this corridor. This is a couple of the mining majors, BHP and Rio Tinto, working together with a couple of shipping companies. That would be Oldendorf and Starbulk. And so they're formulating a contribution, as it were, to the advancement of this green corridor, explaining how they would like to develop their business towards zero emissions on that lane. We expect a lot more activity on that corridor in the coming years because we think it has a number of advantages. There are some other activities going on around the world, though, which are also very, very interesting. There was a notable announcement this year of a partnership between the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Shanghai to develop a green shipping corridor between those two ports. Now, that is largely container shipping between those two, as you could probably imagine. And so that's also a very interesting project, and it's come a long way there. There is actually a sort of project structure in place. You know, there are some formal governance documents and all that. So they're a little bit closer to getting to work than probably any of the others. There's also a similar agreement between the Port of Antwerp and the Port of Montreal, which is at an earlier stage still. So there are a number of green corridors emerging. I think these port-to-port collaborations have gotten a lot of attention, and they're a very efficient way to sort of kick things off because you have the two endpoints of the route, right? But I think that's not the only way they'll emerge. I think we really envision green corridors involving national governments as well. So the regulatory authorities related to energy or maritime in national governments on the ends of the corridors being involved, and a very broad sort of value chain involvement. Really, the cost of running zero emission shipping is related to the fuel. So we expect the companies purchasing, burning, and providing the fuel to be super important. So we expect them to be key players in future corridors.
For sure. I was thinking particularly about the iron ore green corridor from Australia to Northeast Asia, because we had Rash Pal Bhatti, who's Vice President Maritime and Supply Chain Excellence for BHP, on, it must be nearly a year ago, in August last year, I think, on the podcast, talking about how BHP was sponsoring low-emission vessels to carry iron ore on that route. And I think Eastern Pacific, the Singapore-based ship owner, is building a series of dual-fuel LNG-powered Newcastlemaxes to carry iron ore on that route. And, of course, Australia exports, I think it's in the region of about 350 million tonnes a year of iron ore to Northeast Asia. So it's the biggest exporter of iron ore on that route. But you have a well-defined route. You know, you've got the one source country, Australia, and then you've got the three main receivers, China, Japan, South Korea, who are all in a relatively relatively close geographical area, at least in shipping terms. And you're passing by the biggest bunkering port in the world in Singapore, which is working very hard to make low carbon fuels available. So there are already lots of the pieces in place, I suppose, aren't there, in that particular supply chain, which can allow the green corridor to develop.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some of the conditions that are necessary. I think the simplicity, the sort of operational simplicity, is really key here, for especially in bulk where there's a lot of tramping. This is a case where you can almost run that trade in a liner fashion back and forth between three stops. It's interesting. I'm glad to hear you had Rush Paul on. They're obviously one of the signatories to this this consortium we put together, and he's been very involved with it. I think the important thing with the LNG example that you provide is the sort of the mindset. The sort of the concept was there, or was familiar. And doing a similar thing with ammonia-powered vessels is not a totally foreign idea. That said, of course, if it is green ammonia that's going to power this route in a zero-emission future, it's very likely that it will be bunkered directly in Australia. So the role of Singapore would change in this case, likely. That's probably not a major problem. There'll be lots of other trade that Singapore can bunker zero-emission fuels for.
Sure. Thanks for that. It's good to know that, you know, there are examples under development and some of the elements which are important. You also talked in the presentation to the Ship Energy Summit audience about the S-curve. And I think lots of us are used to the concept of the S-curve in economics, where new technologies are created and then slowly adopted, and we accelerate up the S-curve until they become mature. We're basically talking about the same thing here, aren't we?
It is the same idea. And you know, the reason we started looking at the sort of S-curve concept in relation to shipping's transition is that we wanted to see where we needed to be at 2030. The Getting to Zero Coalition, which the Global Maritime Forum was one of the founders of, had a long-established goal of commercialize zero-emission vessels and fuels by 2030. When we started to think about how far do we need to have gotten in 2030, we could use the S-curve thinking to sort of derive that answer, to say, okay, if we know the general shape of an S-curve, and we know that we need to be at zero by 2050, where would we need to be so that 2030 is at the start of the steep part of the S, right? So back calculating that, we landed at around 5%. So around 5% of global fuels would need to be zero-emission fuels to give an indication that the market is mature enough for a rapid scaling. And I think, you know, one of the really important things to say about shipping's S-curve is, because the sector compared to some other sectors is a little bit late in its decarbonization journey, that steep part of the S is going to be very steep indeed, right? So you're going to need to be at a point where there is a mature set of technologies, a mature set of business models, and strong incentives in place to make sure that zero-emission fuels and vessels are displacing conventional fuels and vessels everywhere in the world and very rapidly. So all new vessels and lots of retrofits after when that curve starts getting steep. But of course, green corridors are really about getting there. It's about building those business models and technological designs and value chains and operational profiles, and getting that all in place so that when 2030 arrives, we're ready for, you know, and presumably there's fingers crossed, a strong market-based measure globally in place at that point, that this rapid scale-up and displacement of conventional vessels and fuels can happen. So I think that's, you know, that's why green corridors are interesting, because it's not just about doing pilots and demonstrations and proving concepts. It's about creating a context for those pilots and demonstrations so that they can be done at scale, so that lots and lots of experiments can go on a given route that has good conditions for it.
For sure. And I think if shipping is coming a little bit later than other sectors to decarbonization, does that mean that some of the low carbon and zero carbon fuels will already be made available to other sectors, so shipping can kind of hitch its wagon to fuels that hopefully are already in existence? Or is shipping going to have to compete that much harder to get a share of the pie of zero carbon fuels?
It's an interesting question. It's a question a lot of people are debating right now, and I don't have a definitive answer to it. But I mean, I think it's important to say that given the scaling needs, the fuels that can meet that steep part of the S-curve are going to have to be fuels that can be scaled up rapidly. And we think that probably means fuels based on hydrogen, and probably to a large extent green hydrogen, hydrogen based on electrolysis. Now, of course, that's also the golden ticket for a lot of other hard-to-abate sectors. So there are a lot of sectors looking at green hydrogen as their abatement solution. Whether that is a problem or an opportunity sort of depends on what the industry decides to do. And I think that, you know, we see shipping as a potential early off-taker. These hydrogen projects, there are very ambitious hydrogen strategies in place, a lot of announcements made, but these production announcements, they need reliable, scaled, large-scale off-takers to make their investments bankable. And we hope that shipping will be one of those. Now, shipping's not going to take the hydrogen as hydrogen. It's going to take the hydrogen as ammonia or methanol, global shipping anyway. Domestic shipping may use a fair amount of green hydrogen directly. I think at the beginning, shipping can play a leading role in underwriting some of these green hydrogen and green ammonia and green methanol production projects. In the long run, there may indeed be efficiencies as well to joint, not the long run, in the medium term, joint offtakes with other industries. So helping lower the cost and share the risk by having joint offtakes with steel or chemicals or whoever it might be.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Let's get back to the green corridor element, because I sort of took you a bit off topic there, but I was interested to get your view on you know, how shipping will compete for those fuels. And I very much would agree, in my conversations with fuelers and with ship owners, we talk a lot about how the entire value chain has to be in place. You know, nobody's going to build a green ammonia plant until they know they can sell the green ammonia, and nobody's going to build the green ammonia ships unless they know that the ammonia is going to be available. So it's not quite chicken and egg, it's just getting everybody aligned. But on the green corridor concept, so, you know, we accept we're at the bottom of the S-curve for technological transition, and we're going to go pretty vertical very steeply after 2030 as we get into that sort of diffusion stage of spreading the fuel around. But how do we actually make the green corridor happen? What are the, you know, you talked about the elements of the green corridor, so, you know, things like collaboration and thinking about the different fuels, which fuel you're going to have, and getting governments on side and having public and private elements all lined up. But how do we then go from that to developing a green corridor route?
Right. Well, I mean, I think those building blocks have to be in place. And you know, the collaboration element is sort of like, okay, if you don't have that, you can't even get started. And I think really getting the stakeholders engaged in something in a more or less formal sense is going to be important, right? Because otherwise what you've got is a bunch of demonstration projects, a bunch of industry consortia that are working at similar problems, but in an unconnected way. So I think some kind of effort to engage industry systematically, the whole value chain. And remember, this isn't necessarily the traditional shipping value chain. There's going to be power companies and electrolyzer manufacturers and, you know, a lot of new actors that need to be connected to shipping. So I think a systematic effort to do that is going to be important. And, you know, we see ourselves as, you know, we're one actor that can help bring industry together. And there are many others as well. But that's going to be important. And I think from the start, making that engagement a public-private engagement so that government isn't coming in after the fact and saying, okay, we have all this industry activity, now we need to regulate it. It will be much more efficient if there's a public-private dialogue from the beginning so that you know, there's a joint sense of what's possible on what timeline. I like to promote the idea of a route map for these corridors so that the various decisions that individual companies or consortia of companies or regulators need to make are sort of laid out on a timeline, so you know, okay, by here we have to have this framework in place, we need to sign this offtake agreement and have this engine available, and you can really get a shared sense of what's required to develop the corridor ecosystem. So I think that kind of thing is very important. You'll also need a reasonable amount of analysis. I mean, before you even start building a route map for a corridor, you're going to need to know which corridor, so there'll need to be some evaluations of different options, which are the most feasible and most desirable to focus on. And then, you know, you'll need other kinds of analytical work as well. But I think that, you know, getting to this stage where we have a public-private effort and this guiding roadmap or route map that frames that effort would be a huge success. I think if we can get there during the course of this year, and I think, for example, LA and Shanghai will be there this year, and I hope some others will too, that you'll have a sort of shared plan that's guiding the actions of different actors, you know, that would be a big success. And I think, you know, that it wouldn't hurt to have that embedded in public programs. So in Europe, we have the, you know, it's quite common to have national innovation programs that sponsor sectoral innovation. And something like that for shipping related to green corridors, I think, would be smart. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the leading countries go down that route. But whether or not there's a formal government program, having a public-private dialogue and a shared reference point, like a roadmap or route map, would be, I think, a really important way to get things started.
Mm-hmm. So that route map isn't... it's not a nautical map. It's more like an engineer's or a project manager's Gantt chart.
Exactly.
Saying, you know, this is where we want to get to, and here's the critical path of how we get there. This can't happen until this has happened, and this can't happen until that's happened, and you kind of work backwards from to where you are today, and then you can stress test that to see how long it's going to take you to achieve what you want to achieve.
You're better at explaining things without visuals than I am. That's exactly what I mean. Yes. But this idea of technology road mapping is very common in industry, right? So we'll say, okay, if we need to get to solar panels at $1 a watt by 2030, here are the milestones we need to get there and the actions needed to reach those milestones. And so a corridor is sufficiently complex that I think a shared document of that kind could be really valuable. And I don't envision that it would be a formally adopted thing necessarily, right? So it's really more every organization is going to have to make their own formal plans, but to have something to be able to refer to so that you know what other people's plans are being based on could help, again, overcome this inertia from the beginning.
So, yes, this goes further than self-interested decarbonization. This is the way in which we can collaborate across different elements of the value chain and with the public sector as well.
Yeah, by 2030, we're going to need lots and lots of self-interested decarbonization, because the only way we get the steep scaling is with competition, right? So when we get that rapid rollout, that's companies making money. Right now, we need strategic collaboration in order to lay the groundwork for that. I don't think there's any way we can do it in a purely open market.
Yeah, and I think more and more of us are now coming to the conclusion that that's only going to happen when we get a global market-based solution, as we just everyone keeps using the phrase.
Rapid piece, yes, surely, yeah, sure.
Yep. Yeah. So that's a global carbon tax or contract for difference or some other market-based measure.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, those the zero emission solutions are likely to be more expensive in perpetuity than fossil fuels, right? So there's going to need to be some mechanism in place to make zero emission solutions competitive in order to get them to displace the incumbents. But and I think even in the green corridors phase, while you may have a lot of companies who have a strategic reason to invest in these things, the costs are sufficiently high that there's going to be a role for government subsidies. I think because green corridors are not multilateral, they're probably bilateral between two countries, it will have to be national governments providing the support rather than the IMO. But I think there will be a need for some support. I think the good news is that if you take it not just on a country-to-country basis, but on a specific route basis, if you target the good opportunities, that those subsidies don't have to be outrageously expensive, right? You're decarbonizing iron ore. You're not decarbonizing all, ocean traffic between the two countries. You're targeting a route that can bear some of its own costs and is likely to succeed, and it brings down the threshold for public support, one can hope.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah. Jesse, it's been fabulous having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time. We're coming towards the end of our allotted time now, so just want to say thank you and appreciate you coming along, not just to the Ship Energy Summit, but to the podcast as well. Before we go, what's the website, or where can people go to if they want to find out more and maybe read the report that you've mentioned in our conversation?
Yes, for sure. We're at globalmaritimeforum.org. That's our website, and all of our reports are there. We produce a fair number of reports. The report I'm referring to is called The Next Wave. It's available there, and it was done in partnership with the Energy Transitions Commission and McKinsey & Company. So that was published last year, but it's still available on our website. And we're doing new analysis every day, so keep your eyes open. We're looking forward to working directly with specific countries and specific routes to use this analysis to push the case further. There's a long way to go still.
Okay, and then if people want to potentially get involved with the Global Maritime Forum or become a partner with you, then presumably your contact details or your colleagues' contact details are available on the website there.
All that information is there, and we of course welcome everybody's interest. It's an enormously complex problem, and the more we talk to each other, the better chance we have of solving it.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, and I hope that everybody takes some time to have a think and have a read and get in touch with Jesse and his colleagues if they think they can contribute. Jesse, thanks so much. And thank you to all of you out there in podcast land. This has been Mark Williams with another episode of the Ship Energy Podcast. And tune in again soon for more edification, illumination and enlightenment. Thanks very much, and bye for now.